You're listening to the Manufacturing Ignition podcast. Keep updated with the latest news, recruitment advice, and hot topics within the UK manufacturing industry. Sponsored by Bonfire Recruitment, helping manufacturing leaders across the UK to attract the best talent for their manufacturing company. Ignite your business or career today by visiting www.bonfirerecruitment.com. Here's your hosts, Terry Mallin and Scott Buchanan.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Manufacturing Ignition podcast hosted by myself, Terry Mallin, and my co-host, Scott Buchanan.
Hi Terry, how you doing?
I'm okay Scott, how are you?
I'm alright, although I'm feeling as though I'm turning into a Scrooge already. Can you believe Christmas is but just pushing shy a month away? What's going on?
Actually, do you want to know what? I'm seeing more Sky movies with Christmas things on every single day. You know, supermarkets have been like this since September. And I know a lot of the food companies that I work with are obviously really, really busy at the moment. It won't be long until Christmas is round the corner.
Yeah, remember last week we were talking about, you know, I guess phone etiquette and so on. And one of the things is there, I mean, I received, and I guess I actually love Christmas and I can't wait till that period, but it's more that period. And for me, the middle of November really isn't Christmas period, do you know that way? So I guess how, you know, when is the right time to start looking at Christmas? You know, when should it be? And I know come January, we'll start seeing Easter eggs again. Is that the way to do it? I don't know.
Well, do you want to watch? See, this week I put it in reverse actually because I've went on a health kick, which normally you would do in January, but I've started it now just in the run up to Christmas, just because I know, you know, at the end of the day, it's one of those ones where actually just to feel better as well. So yeah, I'm already signing up for gym memberships too early that I'll probably use for a couple of weeks and then I'll just pack it in.
Get rid of that, the pre-Christmas belly, eh?
you could say that. So, guys, for those tuning in for the first time, both Scott and myself have been working within manufacturing recruitment for over 15 years combined, and that's been all specifically within management or technical recruitment. And over the past 2.5 years specifically, we've been growing our own business, which is Bonfire, to be a leader in recruiting within the manufacturing sector across the UK. We started this podcast to give a completely impartial view on the latest manufacturing news, discuss specific hot topics and give an insight into recruitment and people retainment. So cracking on with episode 4. I can't believe we're on episode 4 already, Scott.
Doesn't time fly when you're having fun, eh?
Oh, it does. It certainly does. So this week, what we'll be covering, the latest news as always, the hot topic will be on current issues affecting manufacturing today, and our recruitment minute is going to be on the final two solutions to the problems discussed on previous episodes. So this will be the final two solutions to the problems. So we'll just get cracking, eh, Scott? So what's the latest news this week?
Sounds like a plan. Okay. Well, it's this time of year is always interesting from a manufacturing perspective because I guess, as you just quite rightly said, it's busy times, but it's also a time where there seems to be quite a lot of awards coming out, and there's been a few that caught my eye. Actually, two within the same competition, it would appear, but the 2017 Shell Livewire top 10 innovators competition, and then the results were announced in the last week or so, whereby there's actually two UK entries that were in the top 10, and this is a global, you know, it's a global piece. There's a company called Acceleron, where Carlton Cummins, who's co-founder of, has been named the overall winner, receiving $15,000 rather worth of prize money. Yeah, not too bad. But see, what caught my eye was the business has created an innovative solution on the problem of waste batteries. So they're harnessing the untapped health of recycling lithium batteries, which is typically over 70%, and they extend the use phase for cut consumers. And once the original stored energy is used up, Acceleron repurposes the battery as storage for renewable energy, which can then be endlessly replaced. So it's, you know that way where I think typically we use, is it lead acid batteries? Do you know that way?
Yeah.
I think that these guys can now produce this kind of quality of renewable energy battery for the same price as a lead acid battery. It's incredible.
Wow, that is.
So I guess time with your Christmas toys, you know, that you know, the bunny that you like playing with at Christmas, you know, that'll keep going on and on.
All right, interesting. And who was second then?
It was a Scottish gentleman, Fergus Moore. He's transformed a coffee waste. So you know, if you go, you get your posh coffee sometimes, and you know, you get the nice coffee at one side, but you get that massive messy coffee waste. I don't know what
the
term is, but
for the ground beans, or like
He's managed to convert that waste into biofuels with his company. I think it's called Revive. Yeah,
good idea.
He got seven and a half grand or so from Shell as well for being a runner up. So not too bad.
Tell you what, if that's used wisely and it takes off, we'll get more than 7.5k investment going forward. That's good stuff. Because think about the amount of people that drink coffee these days. You know, you just need to sign up a big contract with your Starbucks and Costa, and that's you. Job done.
Do you know that way?
You know, produce that into the pellets.
Well, there's an energy piece, but there's also the targets that each of the, you know, governments, I'm going to, you know, certainly the UK, but I'm sure further afield as well, have all signed up to as well. So again, tying in with what you're saying, volume of coffee getting used, you know, this, you know, it's a great innovation. So well done to both of them, actually to some of the other countries as well. You can see it on their own website.
Yeah.
But they're some really good ideas. So
the top two winners were both from the UK, and they were the only people from the UK out of the top 10?
Yeah, and you're looking at other countries such as Nigeria, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, Italy, Nigeria, again, Trinidad and Tobago. So they're all get a lesser, you know, still $5,000. So, yeah.
And I looked into Shell Livewire years and years ago, and I'm, you know, that is an organisation. They help entrepreneurs to start their own businesses. Yeah, I think I've been running for about 30 odd years, and you know, they kind of provide support such as like training, workshops, grants is a big thing that they're known for, and obviously awards and mentoring as well. So it's a really interesting organization. So well done to those guys. And then moving on to the next bit of news, Scott.
Yeah, well, tie in with, I think, podcast 2 we touched on was the Industrial Revolution, I guess. Or the fourth industrial revolution, rather, there's been a few since, this week is LCR 4.0, which is the UK's manufacturing first that aims to put Liverpool City Region at the heart of an evolution which is going to transform production in the modern world economy.
Do you want to know what? I have seen that, Scott. I have seen that because obviously I do a lot of work in the Northwest. And if I, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think these guys have been going for about a year. But I know they've been helping manufacturing businesses specifically within Liverpool, giving them some practical support.
Reading between the lines, I think, I mean, it's a European funded idea, or there's certainly budget coming from that, and we'll touch on this later on about, I guess, what the future holds, but it looks as though they've got it's to support that part of the world rather. But I mean, they're looking at, you know, connecting and innovating, digitalizing and then growing, you know, businesses, but it's supporting, you know, it's SME related, you know, manufacturing companies and the supply chains, you know, so things, you know, companies that are looking within, I guess, big science, life sciences, advanced manufacturing, you know, low carbon and renewable technologies, and I guess more the creative and digital piece as well, seems to be what they're going after.
Looks good.
Yes.
Looks good. I'm actually on the website at the minute, so I mean, the thing that they've got, there's a lot of good detail in there. If anyone wants to check that out, it's lcr4.uk. You know, the benefits of this would be if you're looking to, you know, the schemes get set up to increase productivity and give good innovation ideas to manufacturers. So that could be like virtual reality, Internet of Things, or cloud computing, and how they can adapt that to improve productivity, which hopefully improves cash within the business as well. But I think the big plan, looking at this, the programme runs until 2019. They expect to work with 200 businesses, support 70 new product development projects, and that will create 60 new jobs out the back of it. So, yeah, check that out, lcr4.uk. As I said, good info, case studies, and there's a contact tab. We've got no affiliation with the company. I've never spoke to anyone within the company, but they look pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's the way the world's going as well, do you know, that way. And I'm guessing this is similar to some of the the Scottish organisations, you know, the Advanced Pharma Research Centre and so on, whereby it's actually helping, you know, up-and-coming businesses, I guess, or established businesses that are looking to implement a modern way of working as well, you know, to move with the times and make more money, I guess. So, yeah.
Oh, exactly. I mean, if you take your Fergus Moore that you mentioned in the first piece of news, you know, once he gets up and running and gets a bit of funding behind him, you know, if he's taking advantage of any of the opportunities to increase productivity of that product, then, you know, that's the type of thing that would be hugely beneficial.
Definitely. But moving on, and a topic close to your heart, I know, is that one of Scotland's largest producer of marmalade and jam is embarking on a $3.9 million investment to expand their own site by 50%. All right, so there's going to be more jam for your toast in that Saturday morning that you always look forward to.
Good. And I know Mackay's is a company. In 1995, they were making 10,000 jars a year.
Right.
And now, 2017, they make about 25 million jars a year. So it's, I mean, that's over 22 years, and I know they employ about 180 people. So, yeah, I mean, this is only going to further improve the company taking advantage of the opportunities that are presented. It's good jam. I do like it. My toast, that is really good. So, and off the back of that, Scott, actually, when you're talking about the company investing, the Scottish Food and Drinks Companies, our manufacturers can benefit from a £4.6 million grant. Now, this is a government grant. It has been shared out already to the necessary companies, but the whole purpose of it was to safeguard and create new jobs and actually boost productivity.
Okay.
So I know the type of stuff. When I was looking down the list of the companies that have received this funding grant, you know, some of them are using it to support new products, extending existing lines, you know, building new facilities or upgrading existing equipment. So it was good to see the Scottish Government actually backing food manufacturing companies to increase opportunity for future.
Definitely. No, it's good that is there. And I guess that's going to tie in where actually going forward with the whole European piece that's kicking in, you know, how that actually is going to work out longer term. But we'll touch on that maybe a little bit later on then.
Is that you, Scott? I was going to say, did you hear?
Yeah, is that you
falling
asleep again, or is that
another talk called Kevin? No, do you want to know what? Kevin's sitting in the office chair, and he's normally very... Here he goes again. He's making another yawn. He must be so bored that listening to us two talking. That's quite funny. So he's yawning away in the background.
Green with us, that's fine.
and then finally, Scott, on to what the last piece of news, which is right up your street, which would be the oil and gas sector.
Good news. Confidence is coming back. There's that things are sort of stabilising, and actually there's an element of growth factor in there, which is one of the major things. So yeah. And this is, I guess, despite that there's a no-deal Brexit could double trade costs for the sector. So there's a latest State of the Economy paper by the Scottish Government chief economist, a chap called Gary Gillespie. And we should maybe try and get a hold of him to get a bit more clarity in this. But
they're
looking ahead. Conditions for growth in the oil and gas sector and its supply chain, i.e., you know, manufacturing and engineering supply chain, are more favourable now than they've ever been in recent times. Oil and gas production in Scotland, believe it or not, increased by 2.9% in 2016-17, which, you know, with the latest quarterly sales revenue approaching pre-2014 levels, which is great news because things were a bit more tricky.
That was before the bubble, before everything went downhill a bit, or downstream, should I say?
Yeah, I think there's also, you know, there's a few things that are challenging in there, but one of the things that caught my eye, and I remember having conversations with leaders within the industry and the supply chain of, whereby, as you know, having worked in manufacturing recruitment, and as Kevin knows in the background, as he's agreeing with me, is that within manufacturing, we tend to look at improving, you know, is there an element of consistent, continual improvement culture, whether it's, you know, within the production piece, in the engineering piece, or across the business. And one of the frustrations that, I guess, the oil and gas or the differences within that sector is that it's more around the lines of they may well not embrace as fully, you know, the continual improvement piece. I've got one example where the senior member of within a quality team, you know, within one of the major operators, admitted that he used to work in manufacturing where their standards were actually 20 years prior to the standards he was actually working to, purely from a quality perspective at that time. So there's a lot of change that's obviously happened in that industry. You know, to actually so come on to the point that actually the average cost of producing a barrel of oil in the UK is now half from $30 to $15 apparently.
To actually produce it. So that's actually taking the oil out the ground and putting it in to be sold as crude oil.
I'll be interested to see, because I know that the North Sea is actually one of the tougher places in the world to get the oil out of. Do you know that way? So there is additional costs in there. So it would appear that the UK has definitely reviewed the processes and made themselves leaner, more efficient, and maybe made some changes that allows the extraction of that oil to become more cost effective. So all good. So fingers crossed, because that is a massive market.
So out of interest, Scott, if it's went down to $15 a barrel to produce it, how much is it now? How much is it selling for? Because it used to be like about $100 a barrel back in the day. What's it kind of selling for now?
Back in a long day ago, I think I had a conversation 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago, and at that point, the break even number they were trying to hit was a £60 mark. You know, that's what, once they hit 60 or over, it was cost effective. But because it's been hanging around, Terry, it's been as low as, it's been down at the 30s, it's been down, it's been really low. I think it's now stabilised. I haven't checked today, I probably should have. I don't know if you're still Googling away there, but I'm sure it's around the 60, $65 a barrel or so presently.
It says there, I've just literally just Googled it there, and it says it's around the $60 a barrel, so you're bang on actually there, Scott. It's costing $15 to produce it, and it's getting sold as crude oil, barrel is $60.
Yes, so on the basis that it's crude oil and it's to the relevant standards, that's what it would be. But you need to remember that number is only relevant how the UK would compete in the global marketplace. Do you know that way?
Okay.
So, say you maybe went to, Saudi Arabia, where actually it's, £3 to produce the oil. Do you know that way? That £15 or £30 is almost irrelevant, isn't it?
But amazing.
The cost is, of course, getting into the UK. So there's a number of factors that kick in, and I'm by no means no expert. In fact, it's a learning curve for me as well. But
good though. That was interesting.
It's all good news. But from a manufacturing standpoint, it will hopefully mean there's more work happening, so that the smaller companies, and I'm sure the bigger companies as well, there's more work to ground, and things will work out for the longer term. And these oil rigs that were piling up in Aberdeen and beyond are now out doing some work. And from my own personal perspective, I'm just chuffed that they've actually embraced a bit of continual improvement in there. So that's good news.
Yeah, good, Scott. So moving on to the manufacturing hot topic this week. For those listening for the first time, every week we discuss a specific hot topic on the industry. In the previous weeks, we've discussed autonomous cars, Industry 4.0, the update, and last week we did the food-to-go sector, how it's a multi-million pound business that's only going to be growing. This week, Scott, what's the topic we're going to be covering?
Thought it was relevant. There's a lot of challenges at the moment within manufacturing, and I think it's very easy just to assume that all businesses have actually considered it. And so I think we'll look at actually the challenges within manufacturing. I think
So the current challenges today in manufacturing as we are sitting here in November 2017.
And with a short-term view, not necessarily a long-term view, but certainly a short-term view to the next 6 months, a year of actually what's potentially happening. Because at the moment, as you're fully aware, and most people within manufacturing, manufacturing outperforms every other sector in exporting. 45% of the UK export is actually 45% of the UK exports, and almost 60% of that goes to the EU. That way, so there's a bigger question in there about actually we're making all this stuff and the majority of it's going to the EU, and now we're realizing actually what is our relationship with the EU?
I think.
And then I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, even if we hit the first nail in the head, Scott, with regards to BritEx, because that's the big one that's going up, that everybody's aware of, because the impact of BritEx in manufacturing, you know, can be very disruptive, obviously, to current business models and plans. And that could be from exactly as you just mentioned there, a supply chain side of it, you know. So that might be importing or exporting. You know, there's a massive impact in that. Secondly, as I'm very well aware, you know, is the labour skills. And a lot of people that I've been discussing with over the last sort of 3 to 4 months who are European citizens working in the UK they certainly have the concern, and they're reviewing whether they stay in the UK subject to what happens BritEx.
Yeah.
And move back.
I mean, that is,
you know, well, exactly. I mean, give you an example, you know, down the southeast of England, a lot of European labour is used within the fruit and veg or fresh produce industry. And with that, you know, at the end of the day, it's a very, that's a very challenging environment to recruit people at the best of times. If a European workforce had to leave, then it's going to have a major impact. That'll be major impact on that sort of fresh produce, which is only going to impact the shelves and supermarkets, etc. And as you know, so it's very much to be aware of. And I know when you were mentioning a couple of quotes there, Scott, so I know so manufacturing, looking at it online at the minute, and the CBI report, 45% of the UK manufacturing, 45% of exports comes from manufacturing, and over half of that is then supplied into the EU. So that supply chain's really important.
It's scary. And just tying in with your comment there around the, you know, the southeast, I guess, is what you're saying, you know, where there's a massive you know, food producing now. There's going to be a bit of engineering and a bit more heavier stuff there. But see that actual manufacturing output to the UK economy on an annual basis, it's as much as it's 48% of the UK total. It's 19 billion.
Wow, that's phenomenal. That is phenomenal.
So, you know, those companies will all been not fighting, you know, but they'll been in trying to attract the best talent for their organisations, you know, in that part of the world. And all of a sudden, you know, these people will be wondering, well, actually, you know, we might want to review whether, you know, we should stay here. Now, I don't know what your honest thoughts are, Ted. My personal view is I think there'll actually be an element of flux, I guess. But I do believe that there's probably no reason for the majority of these people to actually to really, you know, to up and leave just now, because I think
I hope so, the
impact of the UK economy is too it's massive. They're not going to let it happen.
I hope so. You know, I mean, that would be the worst case scenario that people do leave, and I hope that's not the case. But you know, it's prudent for manufacturing leaders to be seriously thinking about this and actually having some sort of contingency plan in place as well. You know, even as I was touching on, Scott, you know, the food manufacturing, it's not just about the sort of labour side of it. We look at exports, there's a possible implication of tariffs between an EU single market and the UK, which could massively increase costs for manufacturers. So talking about food manufacturers specifically, they could face an average EU tariff of 22.3% against the current 2.3% for non-food products. Okay, so it's not just all about factoring in the labour side of it. It's actually, there's going to be possible implications. Now, there'll be positive implications and there'll be negative implications, and it's actually weighing that up.
The bottom line is, though, that there's a potential additional cost in there, and these companies, especially in, you know, in the food sector, the margins are quite tight. And actually, if you're making, I don't know, you'll know better than I do, Ted, if you're making 100,000 cakes, do you know that way, you know, you put the cost of sugar up by 2 pence or 5 pence because of a tax, you know, versus the volume that's actually getting used. You know, it's you know, and it won't be just one part of the ingredient. I'm sure it'll be plenty of others, and it'll all soon add up. And if the cost of labour is having to increase as well, you know, there's a whole other argument there. Therein lies another question, Terry, as well. The reason that the UK is heavily relying on labour from further afield is because that UK nationals haven't really wanted to graft away and doing, I guess, less challenging roles. do you know that way? So do you think the UK labour market is maybe more evolved now? Do you think that there is potential that there's potentially schemes that would allow individuals to go and take some of these jobs back? I don't mean that we're taking jobs off anyone that's in a present role, but if people leave their jobs and there's vacancies, would there be a pool of individuals in the UK to fall into that? Or is it a case of whereby this, industry 4.0 is actually very relevant, by actually a bit of forward thinking and a bit of investment is the way to do it?
I think that's two very valid points, Scott. I think the first point is a different topic in its own, but as we've previously, Industry 4.0 definitely highlights actually where this could be hugely beneficial for minimising risk and disruption for business leaders within manufacturing, 100%. And then, so that's exports, and if we're looking at a lot of innovation and R&D is supported by Europe, and I know a lot of EU funding is supplied to R&D, and manufacturing has, manufacturing R&D accounted for 67% of the total UK R&D expenditure. And that was 2014, so I'm slightly out of date. But it gives you an idea of how hugely and highly exposed that manufacturing R&D is. And any changes to any funding schemes is going to have a major impact. So that has to be considered. That's got to be, it's one of the issues that might affect manufacturing.
Do you remember when, there was companies that, it used to be, especially within manufacturing, you had an R&D stroke design focused team that then would work closely with the manufacturing, on-site team or on-site within the UK team to develop the product, and it all kind of works succinctly together. What happened about, 8 years ago, certainly in my career, was that plenty of organisations were tempted over to China and other parts of the world to do the manufacturing piece, and some actually fully shut down and ran away, and others actually kept some form of presence. And what has actually happened, which is relevant to this, is that a lot of manufacturing still does happen in China, but the quality standards and actually the unidentified costs that were involved, it was actually more prudent to keep things in the UK, and they've actually got formal design teams, in the UK of these companies. But these companies, they need, there's an element, there's an incentive as well for these companies to actually do that, and there's a government incentive, and there's actually companies, I'm aware of people that actually work in the sector that they work with manufacturing companies, and happy to help anyone that's found themselves not got this tax rebate, but there's actually companies on the basis that there's been R&D work done that they can actually, they can literally go through the process to claim that back. And it's exactly the volume of numbers you're talking about, Terry. So I wonder if, again, tying in with this EU piece, will the UK government, do a similar scheme? And what will that actually mean to manufacturing? Because at the end of the day, if you're not leading the way from a design perspective, then it's cheaper to make stuff elsewhere, probably, to the what quality standards. There's a big question mark on that. But the world's changing. So what do you think, Terry?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you, Scott. I think it's a valid point, because what we're looking at as the effect of funding was taken away or whatever, but what we really need to be thinking about is the positive side of what the UK government would do in return, and make sure that if that's not equal value, if it's not more, because we should be embracing any R&D and actually really establishing the UK as a leader, not only within manufacturing products, but actually innovation and developing new products and exporting that to a global market. And that will position UK manufacturing once again at the forefront of the global scale. And then going on to the last point on our on this is obviously, the addressing the skills crisis. Scott, you probably know more about that.
I think that we need more skills. Certainly, I could, I think one of the challenges that all businesses have is attracting talent. And I believe that within, as it's known in the world now, it's STEM skills, such as science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, apparently. Half of the businesses in the manufacturing sector That's 50, in fact, over half the businesses, 55% are not confident of finding people with higher level skills in these areas, which is, I mean, that's...
Okay.
I mean, you know, literally, you know, people with science, technology, engineering or mathematics skills, there's a, you know, 55% of manufacturing companies in the UK are worried that, that they'll actually not be able to attract that. I don't know what you've seen from any of the programmes that you've done or any of the, I mean that from, you know, graduate programmes and, you know, developing companies, but that's quite a start.
Yeah, yeah, I think things are getting done with that in the background. Maybe not in the scale that, that would be essential, but there's definitely stuff going on. There's a, I've been invited to a couple of STEM events where basically what you would do is go into schools and, you know, for me specifically, it'd be sitting in a high school, a fair or whatever it is, but actually giving careers advice, and it's genuine, these people are interested in STEM careers. And I've actually got, I think, 3 or 4 penciled in the diary for the next 2 months. So, I mean, that's small stuff, but actually in the big, wider scale, if more people's getting involved in that, there's more people exposed to the opportunities within manufacturing and engineering. And that should help going forward. I think, when I was at school, the big thing was you become a lawyer, you become a doctor. And then when the realisation is that you maybe don't really want to do that, then you actually try and work out what's probably the best career for you. And you're probably doing your, you know, starting to do your A-levels or hires, whatever that might be. And then you pick a topic that sounds of interest for university, yeah. You know, and then it's kind of driven about, you know, socially, you know, what you see socially acceptable. And you kind of, you know, so I think if that there's more of a push in the basis of giving, and specifically people at school, more information, as much information as possible, as much exposure to what manufacturing does. And that might be something we can do in future, Scott. We might actually, you know, with the manufacturing companies we do, you know, we could do a video about them all. I remember watching BBC and they were doing the Inside the Factory. I mean, we could probably do something really good in future about that.
Recruitment out to the masses at an early stage so we can get the apprentices, the recruitment apprentices coming through as well.
I don't know about that, but at the end of the day, so it's a, you know, it's good ideas. So Scott, I'm just cautious of time, but I think that was really useful, that hot topic. It was quite interesting actually. So, you know, the key things is BritX, exports, innovation, and then finally a skills crisis. So that was 4 good points I think we made there.
Very much so, and I think it's important factors that are going to kick in and will probably evolve. So we'll probably revisit that maybe second quarter of next year, I guess, to see how things are evolving, because the landscape is doing that.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And so if you're tuning in for the first time also, we always do a recruitment minute on our podcast, and this is a discussion around recruitment within your manufacturing organisation and you know, the angles faced by both people interested in roles within your company, you recruiting the best people for your business as possible. So over the previous 3 podcasts, we've went through 4 potential problems as a manufacturing leader that you face within recruiting the best staff for your company. And the last podcast, number 3, we started on the first 2 of the 4 solutions into those initial problems. So today what we're going to do is we're going to discuss the final 2 solutions to the problem. So kicking off, Scott, I know the one of the problems we mentioned was traditional recruitment processes being outdated, and that could be internally, you know, how everything's handled, and a solution would possibly be a dedicated recruitment partner. And when I was thinking about this actually over the past week, there's a lot of benefits to having a recruitment partner. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean a recruiter, right? That could be someone internal. It could be anyone, right? But actually having someone with a proven track record that knows the industry inside out, and they can demonstrate this. If you ask them, you know, to demonstrate previous work or whatever, they should be able to do that, no problem at all. Someone that's actually, you know, really interested in the manufacturing industry, is integrated into that industry. They want to get to know your business, and more importantly, they want to get to know the team. They want to get a feel for the culture of your business and understand the processes. And it's all good discussing the positives, i.e. growth and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, really who understands the challenges of a specific company and can put in the right skill sets that are going to handle those challenges and actually turn those challenges into a positive impact overall, you know, in the culture, you know, and so someone that will suit into the current existing team. And just to be crystal clear with this, you know, the importance of this is, you know, this is someone that's going to have a direct impact on your success as a business leader, and more importantly as well, the business success. You know, someone that can put the right people in there, someone that who knows the full market, who's got the full market coverage, an expert in manufacturing, is able to attract the best people for your business. You get the right people straight away, it can only benefit everything you're looking to achieve as a business leader. Scott, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's, and I'm not going to cover all ground and some of the topics we've touched on in podcast 1, 2, and 3, but I think at the end of the day, attitude of, you know, giving individual is everything at the end of the day, and actually having, you know, part of, and I think sometimes the biggest factor maybe is that everyone, and sometimes it falls onto, you know, an HR manager or maybe a business owner, or it depends on how they structure the organization, but someone somewhere has a responsibility against recruitment. Probably because most businesses have an attrition, which is fine, and it's actually a positive thing in the right environment, at the right levels, of course. Actually having someone that is in there, understands the business, and whether it's worked with them for a period of time or consistently learns about the business over a period of time, you know, is certainly can only make things quicker, more efficient, and actually allow the, you know, the given manufacturing business to last longer term as well.
Exactly, Scott. You made a good point there. You know, because we deal with a lot of HR managers and business partners, and to be fair, you know, a lot of the guys are, you know, their main focus is on the people within the site. And recruitment is a part of that, but you know, a lot of the guys are spread thinly as well, which isn't fair on HR by any means, unless depending on the volume of recruitment or an internal recruiter by any means, you know. But I think the benefit to using using someone that you can trust is the fact that this person's doing it day in, day out. They're building relationships. They know who's good in the market. They know who's not. You know, and yeah, there's a cost involved in that, of course. You know, it's a business at the end of the day. But, you know, hopefully you do see the ROI, the return on investment off that.
I always smile when I see, and to be fair, I get it actually as well, that the word that recruiters you'll see in many a LinkedIn profile or many a recruiter that you meet over the course will say that they're a specialist recruiter. That's fine if you're recruiting, you know, and if you know you need an engineer and an engineering specialist recruiter. But actually, the most important person that you could have in your business is actually someone that specialises in your business. Do you know that way? Rather than, you know, and understands, because the ethos of that business will be whatever it happens to be. And it's important to work along those lines. And I guess knowing, you know, the HR community as I do and manufacturing and industry, you tend to find that people like doing a good job and are quite proud of what they're doing. But actually relinquishing that control around the recruitment piece, you know, I think there's an argument you could have an extension of themselves that whether it's employed by the business or, you know, through you know, EN other means is not a bad idea to look at it, because it's important
to
the bigger picture.
And I think you see that a lot of people out there that use the buzzword, I'm a specialist, etc. But really, you know, if you're a manufacturing business leader, you know, and you know, you can quickly sense check, you know, who you're dealing with, you know, and ask for some evidence of their previous work, etc. If that person is, you know, good at what they do, they should quickly be able to do that and also provide you some references of why don't you phone X, Y, and Z, because they've delivered roles in the past. You know, that's someone that's creditable and knows our industry. And then obviously moving on to the second solution, Scott, and this kind of dovetails with what we were saying about recruitment partner as well, hiring the right candidate first time. I think so my 2 pence worth again, you know, recruitment processes are really evolving. We talk about manufacturing evolving with Industry 4.0, but there's a big opportunity within recruitment as well. And I think a lot of the time, when we've been working in previous years, you know, a lot of time you're dealing with a hired manager at various levels. You know, most will meet people and then go on, you know, if they tick the experience box, great, and then they'll go in gut feeling if they feel that that person's right for the role. They might do some background checks to ensure that they've got a good egg. But I think in order to enhance that gut feeling and actually make it more concrete, you know, you've got to take this a bit further. And I know through our own process, Scott, and this is what people could implement elsewhere as well, you know, internal recruitment, whatever that might be, we're very, very thorough about what we do. And if we're sending a shortlist for, say, a managing director to a food company or an automotive company or a precision engineering company, whatever that might be, what we ensure is, A, that shortlist includes the candidate's CV. They have a 10-minute video interview where that person is then putting extra information, so a bit more meat about the bones about that person. And the whole purpose of that is actually you will quickly get a feel for that person, and it saves a lot of time as well all round. You get a feel for that person if, A, they can do the job, and B, you know, what their personality is like, and et cetera. Now, to take away the gut feeling on the sort of behaviour and personality as well, we also do a behaviour test. Behaviour's different from personality. Behaviours can change, personalities can't. Now, the reason for the behaviour test, it isn't a tool used to either hire someone or not. It's very far from that. What we do within Bonfire is we will work with a specific business. We will then put all of the senior leadership team and we'll give them the option of doing the behaviour test, which most will do anyway. That gives us an overall profile of how the team's structured, okay, and what the behaviours are like in the team. What we can then do is any candidates that are getting put forward, the candidate will do the behaviour test, and then we can take that profile and put it into the existing senior leadership team or any management team. It doesn't have to be a leadership team. It could be anything. You could benchmark it against the hired manager alone and see how the relationship is. But what it shows you is how the dynamics of that team may be altered, where the strengths are and where the areas to probe an interview are. Very, very useful tool. What this, and the reason why we do such a detail, this isn't, you know, so background checks and gut feeling is important as well as the experience of the person. But if you can give that little bit more information up front and it allows you to probe even deeper at interview, then hopefully that should make sure that, you know, do you know what? You've got enough backing where you're making the right hire every time. You know, because there's a lot of, going back to the final problem, there's a lot of money wasted in hiring unproductive candidates, and we try and minimise that as much as possible by implementing that. How was that, Scott?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fair and crucial. I think that you know, based on it, it doesn't matter what level within, you know, the organisation, time is everything. So our process is designed, yes, to make us more efficient, but actually also to allow clients to have an efficient day and actually still get the, you know, the best talent that they're trying to attract that is correct for their business. I think, you know, certainly the feedback that I've had from my clients and, to be honest, candidates as well, is that the video interview actually gives a fairer, it almost allows people to jump on to like a second interview stage. Do you know that way? Because yeah, at most interviews, you know, I guess there's an element of feeling for each other and sussing out if one could work with each other. In addition, of course, to make sure it's the right candidate for the role. So the actual, it can work in two ways. It can actually allow the conversation to start very specifically about, you know, whatever the role is, and actually getting into the nitty gritty without having to do the softer stuff first, which can maybe be more covered off at the final part, actually, that, you know, with the right candidate. So it's it's time effective. It's arguably cost effective as well. From a, you know, at the end of the day, no one needs to travel anywhere to get to, you know, to meet whatever for a wasted meeting. Arguably,
yeah, exactly.
Isn't the right candidate, and if you do a typical day, you know, what you're talking, you know, four candidates that you're meeting all day, and actually, you know, maybe one of those candidates was the right one, but you still want to see another two. Do you know that way? There's a lot of cost involved. So
exactly.
It's definitely cost and time efficient.
Okay, and I think you know, just to finish up, Scott, just throwing that back in its head, I think, you know, and you don't know this yet, it's something I've seen something today on LinkedIn which kind of got me thinking. It's not always about actually the candidates doing the video. I think what we are going to start implementing as a business, Scott, is actually getting hire managers to do a video and allow them to discuss what they're looking for from an individual, about a background about the business, about a background about the company. Because see, at the end of the day, in this type of market, we're working with people that don't necessarily want to, you know, they're not actively looking by any means, but they want to know about key opportunities that are going to develop their career. And with that, they want to make sure that actually, you know, if they've got that information in front of them, there's going to be more people interested in that particular business, because they'll be able to see what the company does, what the business does, what the team does, what the hiring manager's like. And actually, yeah, they'll be more receptive to actually going for an interview. So I think as a business, Scott, you, obviously this is the first you've heard of it, I think that's what we're going to be implementing going forward. I think it's very important.
It's definitely another tool there, Terry. To be honest, we've done versions of that, haven't we? I guess that's taken it to the next logical stage where, you know, some of the questions that we will ask on the video interview is actually from the client. You know, that way is actually is part of...
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I guess there's, you know, some individuals would are quite comfortable in front of the camera from it, you know, but others may not. So we can still run both processes. That wouldn't be an issue.
Good.
But the output is, you know, making sure that the right person gets the job for the long term.
And it's the best possible person for the company to drive whatever plan or strategy might be going forward. That was good, Scott. I enjoyed that. So, you know, just kind of wrapping up. A lot of good topics there, a lot of good points. Next week we'll be doing similar. I think we're going to try and get someone on a call though. Scott, that's over to you. So I think we'll try and get someone on a call. It'd be great to do that now. Obviously, we'll go through the latest news next week. I think the hot topic, what we'll do is, are the banks truly supporting manufacturers' growth plans? And what that'll be, it won't be specifically completely targeted towards banks, but we'll talk about funding, because manufacturing is obviously improving on the PMI. There's a lot of opportunity with innovation, as we've touched on, with Industry 4.0. More people will be be thinking of it, are in the process of looking to invest in machinery. Therefore, let's have a hot topic about discussing about funding and grants, and focused around it, banks, are they supporting those growth plans going forward? And then the recruitment minute. So that's us. We've done our four problems and we've given you the four solutions. So really a lot for you to think about. I think what we'll do next week, Scott, is we will do the importance of knowing your market to recruit the best people for your business. So that'll be all around, you know, do you know how many people are in your market for any specific sector? You know, do you have access to them?
I nearly said that earlier, actually. It's a natural stem on point from what you were saying earlier about, you know, making sure it's the right candidate for the, you know, first time round. And the only way of doing that is knowing that, you know, the size of your market and, you know, the individuals in there. So we can talk about that. That's a good idea, Terry.
And then, you know, in future podcasts, we might do, well, do you know what? You've got visibility of the whole manufacturing market from a management perspective. How do you define the top 15% in that market to make sure you're getting the best people for your business? I think that would be quite...
Sounds like that one's in your shoulders, Terry.
All right, Scott. Right, thank you very much for that, Scott. That was great. Questions. If you maybe come on the podcast one day and you've got something you want to raise, drop us an email. My email is Terry. That's Terry at bonfirerecruitment.com. Or Scott is Scott at bonfirerecruitment.com. That's Scott, S-C-O-T-T. Thanks for tuning in, and we look forward to the next podcast next week.
Thanks for listening to the Manufacturing Ignition podcast. If you've made it this far, we take it that you enjoyed the show. In return, we'd love it if you'd leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Subscribe while you're there, and we'll catch you for the next episode.